Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
I first started running about 15 years ago as a way to quit smoking. Back then, my running clothes were very Rocky Balboa. So sweatpants, sweatshirt. Anyone who goes hiking or trail running knows that it's a lot easier and a lot more fun when you're wearing the right gear. Jonji makes performance apparel that'll take you farther on your runs and hikes. They have this merino wool hoodie that I wore on multiple trail runs this weekend. It's soft, it's warm, and most importantly, it does not get stinky when you get stinky. Another reason to love Jonji is that they donate 2% of all sales towards clean water projects, raising nearly $1 million so far. Head to jonji.com to find your new favorite trail wear, outdoors accessories, and essentials. And use the code OUTSIDE for 10% off at jonji.com. That's JANJI.com with the code OUTSIDE for 10% off. When I was a little kid, my whole family, grandparents included, packed into a Dodge Caravan and went on a two-week road trip to Wyoming. We saw the rodeo in Cody, a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park, and an epic thunderstorm near Devil's Tower. On that trip, I fell in love with the West and the natural world. This might sound cheesy, but it kind of made me who I am today. Wyoming has it all. Breathtaking hikes, kid-friendly museums, two of the coolest national parks in the country. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
Hey folks, I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Today we've got a double feature. In the second half of the show, we've got a new Ask Sam where we'll tackle some listener questions about bird feeders, black flies, and clouds. But first, it's time for another one of our regular bits.
No other species can defeat them.
They're invasive.
So why don't we just freaking eat them?
Because we're hungry.
Eat the invaders.
This is Eat the Invaders, where we talk about fighting off invasive species by using the somewhat questionable strategy of eating them. This is Japanese knotweed. It's a plant which was introduced, as so many of them are, because it has beautiful flowers and is really easy to grow. In Japan, when a volcano erupts and buries the land in magma, knotweed is often the first plant to break through the rocks and recolonize. It looks sort of like bamboo, with broad, tear-shaped leaves and tall, segmented stalks that can grow to be over your head. But here in the U.S., knotweed is a problem, and it is tenacious. It can grow through foundations, tear apart pavement or stone walls, or just take over your yard. But there's at least a little bit of good news.
In another week or two, as it warms up here, it's going to send up these little shoots. And when it sends those up, the first foot, foot and a half, is edible like asparagus.
That's Ken Hardcastle. He's a winemaker.
What's it taste like?
It's not as nice as asparagus for myself.
So I used to have knotweed that grew up all around my house when I was a kid.
And this is Taylor Quimby, our producer.
And I used to just eat it right off the stalk.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so, like a lot of it.
A lot of it?
Yeah.
Wow.
I used to go out with a wiffle ball bat, and my parents would be happy to just send me off, and I would smash it down. This stuff really comes, this has that nice crack to it.
Oh, yeah.
We are standing in Ken's yard, where alongside a quaint little stream and nearby stone wall, there are two long rows of last year's knotweed, standing 7 or 8 feet high. Now it's all dry and brittle, which, I will say, makes the idea of going into a field of this stuff with a wiffle ball bat seem pretty appealing.
We have hackers and whackers and all sorts of things, and we come out here in the evening, spend an hour just hacking the crap out of it, you know?
It's all your stress, gone.
It's perfect. It's great. I've had friends come over and grab some sort of implement and head out into the woods and just hack Japanese knotweed for a while.
Let me interrupt this regularly scheduled Eat the Invaders segment with a little PSA. If your goal is to limit the spread of this invasive, this is a terrible idea.
Well, I wouldn't recommend that.
Doug Cyan is the state invasive species coordinator and says that even a tiny fragment of the stem, crown, or root can turn into a whole new plant. And what's more, cutting it stimulates growth.
So if you had just a few square feet of stems, all of a sudden you cut it, and the next year you could have, you know, exponential number of square footage of stems.
So Ken and Taylor's chopping probably has led their plants to spread exponentially. Should you actually want to get rid of knotweed, you can spray it with herbicides, or you can cut it down, dry it, burn it, cover the entire area where the knotweed was with the thickest tarp you can find, bury the tarp with wood chips, and leave it there for 5 years straight. So yeah, this stuff is invasive. But for Ken, who loves experimenting with things in order to make wine, and whose blueberry wine was good enough that it was featured on the Today Show, knotweed presented an opportunity.
What I did try doing was to ferment it, because the plant is all over my backyard, and it's supposedly loaded with resveratrol, which is a good antioxidant that's in red wine grapes. So I thought, oh, this is related in some way to red wine. Let's see if we can make wine out of it. So I collect the shoots when they come up, and chop those up and throw them in a fermenter.
Fermentation is a pretty simple process. First, you need yeast and you need sugars. And then you just need to provide a nice environment that the yeast will like to grow in. Certain yeasts will eat the sugar and then basically crap out alcohol.
So I take the plant, put it in some water, and add some sort of fermentable. Honey, maple sap, syrup, corn sugar, anything you got that has sugar in it.
Ken says that process of making alcohol will pull nutrients and color and flavor out of the knotweed or rhubarb or whatever you've got in there and stick it into the liquid.
I made a straight up Japanese knotweed wine when I first made it, after it was in the bottle, pouring it for my colleagues. They were amazed at how it smelled. It had this bouquet of baby wipes, something you pull off your box. They smelled just like baby wipes.
The thing about a bottle of wine is the taste and smell changes as it ages. Ken says the baby wipe smell went away after the bottles sat on the shelf for a few years.
Watch your head down here. It's a little tight and old and gnarly.
Now we're in Ken's basement. It's an old-school, dusty, cobwebby, dirt-floored, kind of wet New England farmhouse basement. This is where he's got one last bottle of the wine that he made years ago out of knotweed.
So this is
K2.
K2, that's the second version of my Japanese knotweed wine where we blended in some blackberries from outside. And gotcha. We're going to bring this upstairs and
all
pull
right.
the cork on.
Do you want me to hold it?
Yeah, sure.
So how long has it been since you opened one of these bottles?
Probably 3 years.
So is it fair to say you don't know what this will taste like?
I think I know what it tastes like. But I'm sure I'm going to be surprised. If it smells like baby wipes, I'm really going to freak out. Whoops, sorry.
No worries. I will say that if you were to ask me to characterize this, complex is definitely a word I would use. And also I would say that that it being an easy drinking wine is probably not words I would use to describe it. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, this is a contemplative wine.
Ultimately, even the knotweed blackberry wine was a little too weird to try to sell in the winery. But the experiment did get another idea swirling around in Ken's head, one that ultimately was economically viable.
This plant, you let it grow like it likes to do, and in August, it sends out these tall, long fronds of little tiny white flowers. They're just loaded. It's beautiful. It's a decorative plant. It's a gorgeous plant. Bees love those flowers. They're going after these flowers, and they're taking that nectar back to their hive. The honey that's put up from Japanese knotweed looks like molasses. People call it black bamboo honey. It's fantastic. It's a very distinctive, very unique honey. I make mead out of that.
Mead, the alcoholic beverage associated with fantasy, Beowulf, Vikings, and Robin Hood's Friar Tuck. It's a drink that's made from fermented honey, and it seems to be making a comeback in certain circles. One newspaper even dubbed it the Game of Thrones effect.
So I make a honey wine commercially at Hermit Woods Winery, made out of the flowers, the nectar from the flowers of Japanese knotweed. We call it knot mead, K-N-O-T, mead.
When we talk about making a honey out of a plant that's an invasive species, if the strategy of eating an invasive species is also a way of getting rid of it, making honey means that you have to wait for it to flower. So it's kind of the opposite.
Well, here's the question. Why do you want to get rid of it if you're getting really nice honey from it? Is it an invasive when it's something that's valuable?
Okay, the truth is, Ken's goal was never really to try to get rid of his knotweed. In fact, his philosophy has a lot more to do with the final product than any thought of keeping invasive species under control. His big idea is that we should be making alcohol out of things that grow really well in our own backyards. And this all started after the first time he tried blueberry wine.
The next day, my buddy Chuck showed up on my doorstep with a bucket full of blueberries and said, Ken, make wine like that.
He's since branched out to try adding random plants that are decidedly not sweet.
Sumac, staghorn sumac, this plant behind us right here, I use it as a natural form of tannin into my blueberry wines and other things to give it more grip.
And he's even made a white wine from heirloom tomatoes that he says tastes just like Chardonnay.
So are you just, when you go for a walk out here, are you just looking around you thinking, like, what around me could I turn into booze?
Yeah, always. You let the Saccharomyces on there, the critter that eats sugar and makes alcohol, do its magic, and you end up with this liquid that's nutritious and connects you to your gods and Mother Earth in new ways.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody refer to getting schwasted quite that way.
Well, that's the way I see it. And actually, you take a honey wine and you connect to Mother Earth like no other product on the planet.
So for Ken, this is not really about eating invasives. It's more like, hey, we should be enjoying what grows in our backyard. So what's the problem with that?
Commercially, people harvest asparagus. So there are devices and tools to make it efficient or ways of harvesting it with people to collect enough of it. And then I could ferment that and turn that into wine. And we won't have to spray it anymore. We'll cut it down and grow it in places so that we can craft it into a wine.
Well, this is the problem. When you get Ken excited about this idea, suddenly he's talking about deliberately planting one of the most invasive species around, which brings up a funny tension here. Remember Doug Sagan, the earnest state worker who fights invasives?
So you're friends with Ken Hardcastle, yes?
Yes, I am.
Have you been to his house?
I have been to his house.
He's got it everywhere.
He does have it everywhere.
Does he drive you crazy? I have to say that it seems like for you two to be friends is sort of like the odd couple a little bit.
It is. I love Ken. He's a great person, and I have a lot of respect for him. And he wants to control that Japanese knotweed on his property. It is getting overwhelming, and with the density of the population there, you'd be hard pressed to be able to throw a baseball across it. It's pretty dense.
So obviously, Ken is not actively thinking of starting a knotweed farm because he is, in fact, trying to eliminate some of the stuff on his property.
So I've been out there trying to assist him on a few weekends last year to try to get a foothold, and we're working on it.
So unlike us, you won't be able to try Ken Hardcastle's original knotweed blackberry wine. But if you want, you can go out in the spring and grab the new shoots when the plant first starts to push up from underground, like we did.
It's a lot more mild than I thought it would be.
Yeah, what did you think it was going to be?
Like super bitter.
No, it's good.
I'd eat this. I'm going to make this into a pie.
It's surprisingly tasty stuff. And in some ways, that's the problem. Because as we've learned, just cutting it actually might help it spread. The truth is, there are many invasive species that can't be controlled by eating them. And for the ones that are edible, what if they taste so good, people just want to plant more of them? Well, isn't that a pickle? So our voicemail box has been pretty full lately, and we're going to answer some of your questions about the natural world. Or try to. After a short break.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
With my busy life, I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up. When I need a jar of extra creamy peanut butter delivered, I know my personal shopper Amber will come through. And if it's not on the shelf, she asks them to check the back. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hello, Sam Evans Brown.
Hey, Maureen McMurray.
Hi, Taylor Quimby.
Hello.
So, Sam, Taylor and I have brought you here to answer some questions.
Questions.
Why do geese make V's?
Does a bumblebee sneeze?
Can a person eat trees?
Can a polar bear freeze?
Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
Okay, so the inbox has been quite full with questions, Sam. Are you ready to answer them?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, well, let's get this party started. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was calling because I have a lot of bird feeders in my yard, and I really like to, you know, watch the songbirds and my indoor cats chatter at them through the window. But a coworker told me that, like, feeding the birds, even if it's high-quality bird food, is actually harmful for them because it, like, makes them stay in places longer than they normally would if they're migratory, and that it disrupts their natural diet and things like that. So is that true? Am I hurting the songbirds in our ecosystem by putting out bird feeders? Tell me if I'm a bird killer or not. Thanks.
Oh, what a bummer of a coworker. Total.
Yeah, come on, man. I just like to watch the birds. So this is a question that has been plaguing the sort of non-interventionist environmentalists for a long time. Like, are we upsetting the delicate balance of nature by feeding birds? And there are a couple of concerns, right? First is, are they staying too long in places that they shouldn't be staying when they should be migrating because there's food for them?
Are they getting lazy?
Are they getting lazy? And then, but more than that, are they staying and then they try to continue on their migration and they like freeze to death and starve because they've stayed for too long?
Oh, okay.
So it's actually bad for them. The other is that they might be transmitting diseases to each other because they're like birding up next to each other. And then there's this third idea, which is they're becoming dependent on the feeders. Like the species that don't migrate away become dependent. And then if you take the feeders away, then they would die. But all these questions have been tested. The migration one, there's a counter argument, which is birds don't look for food to know when they should migrate. They look for daylight and temperature.
Okay.
They have found disease transmission. But then the question is like, okay, on net, is it good or bad to feed the birds? And there's this thing called Project Feeder Watch, which is like this citizen science experiment, which is people documenting what birds are at their feeders.
And are these I'm sorry, is there like a bias in here? Are these feeder enthusiasts who are running it?
They're feeder enthusiasts. Mm.
So,
but hang on. You look at the birds that like feeders from Project Feeder Watch, and then you check to see, are those birds getting more or less abundant, right, based on other data? And the answer is no. They're basically totally unchanged. It's not like the ones that are eating at the feeders are dying.
So maybe the answer is that feeding the birds
is like a purely selfish activity because you get to see them and it costs you a little bit of money, but really you're doing nothing.
Yeah. And like there have been these studies that have found that, you know, chickadees, for example, even if they've got a feeder that is fully stocked, they only get about 25% of their food from it because they're like evolutionarily wired to look for food from different sources because like the food might dry up at any moment.
Interesting. So she's not a bird killer.
Not a bird killer.
Yay!
I thought you were going to say they only get 25% of the bird feed because the darn squirrels get the other 75%.
Well, that is like a whole other part to this.
No, and that's a legit question, right? Like, what about impact on other wildlife? I have no idea.
Hey, Sam. My name is Sarah, and I'm calling from Dunnsville, Virginia. I have several friends who have hiked the Appalachian Trail, through-hiked it, and another friend who's about to start. And she's starting up in Maine in June, and we were talking about how she needs to get a head net to protect herself from all the black flies in Maine and in other parts of the Northeast. So my question is, why are black flies such a problem up in the Northeast, but they're not really problematic at all down here in the South?
So the whole world has species of black flies. In most places, they're pretty harmless. There are some in South America and Africa. There are some that carry this disease that will make you blind, but
that's not good.
Not good there. But in most places, they're just annoying. In places that it's cold, though, the black flies have this very unique thing, which is black fly season. We get swarmed for a couple weeks every year. And the reason for that is because we have cold water. All the flies lay their eggs in the streams, and the larvae in the cold water take a really long time to develop. And so they basically all hatch in the spring because they've got to rush to get the eggs back in the water again so they can hatch in time for the next spring.
Oh, so the black flies in other warmer places are there year-round in much lower frequencies.
Density.
They're just like dispersed. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so they don't have black fly season, which is awful. You understand how like caribou can be killed by enough bug bites when you're in this kind of...
Caribou can be killed by bug bites?
Yeah, dude.
Really?
Yeah. Have you ever seen the caribou migration movie that came out a couple of years ago? They film a caribou being bit by so many mosquitoes that it literally just gets drained and falls
God.
Over and dies.
That is horrifying.
Yeah. It's the worst way to go.
All right, next question.
Hi, this is Margie from Concord, and I feel a little shy about asking this question. It seems like it might be too silly. A couple of years ago, maybe 1 or 2 years ago, I started noticing that the clouds just seemed enormous, just towering high. And maybe they're the same as they always have been, always will be. But my first thought was, there go our icebergs. And I just wondered if there is any connection between icebergs melting and cloud formation, height of clouds, volume of clouds. Thank you.
So the connection is the temperature of the atmosphere, right? So the a hotter atmosphere can hold more water. Now, that's not the question, though. The question is, does more water in the atmosphere make for bigger, more impressive thunderheads?
Cumulonimbus, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Look at the big brain on Quimby.
But then to say, okay, we have more water in the atmosphere, does that mean we're going to have more of these cumulonimbus thunderstorms? I mean, science doesn't know the answer to that, I don't think. But definitely a warmer atmosphere holds more water and therefore should have more clouds. And that's been actually like a big area of debate because clouds reflect sunlight. And so scientists have been like, okay, so if we have a warmer atmosphere and we have more clouds, doesn't that mean we're going to reflect more sunlight, which would attenuate warming? And trying to model that and predict it has been like this hot topic for a number of years.
Amongst nerdy meteorologists, you mean? Because the rest
climatologists. Climatologists.
Yeah, whatever.
Lord Taylor.
All right, next question.
Hi, Sam. This is Emily from Tuscaloosa, Alabama. I'm a preschool teacher, and I was taking my kids out onto the playground this morning. And we always have to check to see if the playground is wet. But since we go out so early, the ground is always wet because there's dew on the ground. And I was just curious as to what causes the dew, because it can not rain overnight, and I know it has something to do with the drop in temperature at night, but I'm just curious as to specifically what causes dew to fall down on our ground.
So, okay, so it is the drop of temperature, right? So the air, you've got a warm air mass, and then the temperature starts to fall, that air starts to cool. A warm air mass has more water in it, and so as the air cools, it squeezes the water out of the air, and that's the dew. But the dew point, which you've heard of, is this number that changes with the humidity. So if it's more humid out, that means there's more water in that air, so it doesn't have to cool as much for there to be dew. So the more humidity, the higher the dew point.
As in the...
The wetter the air, the easier it is for the water to fall out of the air.
So the higher dew point means that the temperature has only fallen a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Versus a low dew point, as in the temperature has to fall all the way down to that low dew point.
Gotcha.
And this is a great opportunity to explain another number you've probably seen in the weather forecast, relative humidity. Mm-hmm. So if the relative humidity of 100% means the water in the air is condensing just as fast as it's evaporating. So 100% relative humidity is a day where like you touch a surface and it feels wet. Because you're literally at the dew point right
now.
Wow. The dew is forming all around you and evaporating at the same time.
God.
That's like when I lived in New Orleans.
Yeah.
I feel like it was like that all the time.
Oh, God.
Those are bad days. Yeah. Those are bad days.
Great place.
That's all I got, folks.
Cool. That was a good round.
Yeah.
Solid learning.
Yeah.
Outside In was produced this week by Taylor Quimby and me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Maureen McMurray, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. If you'd like to see Ken Hardcastle's dusty New England wine cellar, we have got photos. Head on over to OutsideInRadio.org. You can also find more information about some of the studies we talked about during our Ask Sam segment there, too. And if you'd like to get your own question onto the podcast, the number is 1-844-GO-OTTER. That's 844-GO-OTTER. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Additional music this episode was from Poddington Bear and Ari De Niro. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Wow, you're just like jamming your face full of chocolate and wine all at once.
Feel like you got enough to do already? I do. That's why I use Shipt same day delivery to keep up with my busy life. They know the snacks I like down to the extra creamy in my peanut butter. I can get deliveries at home, on set, or even when I'm away on vacay. And my personal shopper, Amber, she's got my back. As in, she asks them to check the back if it's not on the shelf. Shipt. Delight in every delivery. Learn more at shipt.com/hi.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.